My name is Davina Perumal from the University of KwaZulu-Natal. It gives me great pleasure to chair this afternoon's fifth plenary session and to introduce two esteemed speakers in the session, Law and Religion in Africa, Governance, Social Problems, Marriage, Women, Children, Disabled Persons and Education. Our first speaker for today is Professor Johan van der Vever, who needs no introduction. The biography speaks volumes to his writings and his work as an erudite scholar in the field, but just for the closeness between what he and I share in common, we're both Durbanites. Professor van der Vever, over to you.
It might be surprising to those of you who are not South Africans to know that South African law is actually a combination of a very great variety of legal systems. Since earliest times of South African history, the country upheld what is today known as the principle of the self-determination of peoples, which, as pronounced in international law today, is the right of a cultural organization, cultural peoples, to promote their culture, a religious community to practice their religion, and a linguistic community to speak their language without undue state interference. So since early times, South African law permitted tribal groups in South Africa to live and to uphold their tribal customs, and if needs be, to enforce those in the regular state courts if that was required necessary. There was a condition, though, that South African law only upheld customary practices that were consistent with, and I quote, the principles of public policy and natural justice. Based on this premise, South African law recognized a great variety of marriage laws that are practiced in different cultural communities. However, since early times it was decided that marriages concluded under systems of customary law that were in fact or could be in principle polygamous were not recognized. They were regarded as in violation of the principles of public policy and natural justice. This particularly implicated marriages committed in conformity with African customary law, Muslim law, and Hindu law. Under the law of the land, a marriage of yesterday could be solemnized by an official marriage officer registered with the government department of home affairs under the Marriage Act of 1961. This included clergy of most religious denominations. As far as marriages concluded beyond the boundaries of South Africa was concerned, the principle that applied was that the formalities required must be in conformity with the lex loci celebrationis, that is the law of the country where the marriage was concluded. However, marriage concluded beyond the borders of South Africa in a system where the marriage was or could be polygamous was not recognized. In one of the early cases, Seat Executive versus the Master Natal, 1917, Chief Justice Innes had this to say. Bearing in mind the essential characteristics of marriage, it is clear that the union in question was not a marriage as we understand it. It was a relationship recognized, no doubt, by the legal system under which the parties contracted, but forbidden by our own law as fundamentally opposed to the principles and respect. restrictions of our legal system. A family founded on marriage is the centerpiece of the entire legal system of African communities. South Africa, from time to time, enacted legislation to afford protection to partners in customary unions as if they were married, but without recognizing their union as a marriage. Just a few examples. The Native Administration Act of 1927 provided that courts of law would not be competent to decide that the institution of the bola or ugari, that is the payment of dowry, is in conflict with South African law, and they had to enforce it. Section 22, paragraph 7 of the same act protected property rights of female partners in a customary union in the event of a subsequent civil marriage by the husband with someone other than this customary or wife, then her rights were protected. A law of 1963 afforded to family partners in a customary union the right to claim damages from the person held legally responsible for the death of the customary law husband. Those are just a few instances of special legislation that afforded some consequences to the customary unions, but without recognizing them as marriages as such. The 1993 Constitution, the interim constitution, authorized legislation that would afford recognition to religious systems of personal and family law that would acknowledge the validity of marriage concluded under such systems. Nothing was said in the 1993 Act of further substantive constraints, but the 1996 final constitution of South Africa provided that the recognition of such marriages must be set subject to the other provisions of the constitution, basically the Bill of Rights Constitution, for provision. In 1998, the legislature enacted the Recognition of Customary Marriages Act that legalized existing and all future customary unions of Africans. Polygamy is no longer an obstacle. Some of the provisions that are of special interest include Section 6 of the Act, which provides a wife in a customary marriage has, on the basis of equality with the husband and subject to the matrimonial property system governing the marriage, full status and capacity to acquire assets and to dispose of them, to enter into contracts and to litigate, in addition to any rights and powers that she might have under customary international law. So that is just a provision in the Act that tried to secure gender equality in customary unions which are now recognized as marriages. The Protection of Unfair Discrimination Act of 2000 prohibits gender discrimination such as, and I quote, any practice, including traditional customary or religious practices, which impairs the dignity of the woman and undermines equality between women and men, including the well-being of a girl child. The problem is, though, that customary unions, customary marriages, are essentially founded on practices of patriarchy and male dominance. I would suggest to you that polygamy as such amounts to gender discrimination. In KwaZulu-Natal, there was a case, Kumeri was the President of the Republic of South Africa in 2009, that addressed this problem, which dealt with the access and control of family property by women, a upon dissolution of their customary union. Deputy Chief Justice of the time, Dikgano Moseneke, spoke of, and I quote, the stubborn persistence of patriarchy and, conversely, the vulnerability of many women during and upon termination of a customary union. The Constitutional Court upheld this judgment and outlawed the practice of primogeniture under which women could not own property. So South African law has now legalized polygamous customary law marriages as marriages, both existing and future. In trying to secure especially gender equality, our courts are battling with practices that are deeply embedded in African customary law, but which are in conflict with the principles of gender equality, among other things, in the new constitution. And we have not yet come to the end of the road where full gender equality is secured within these marriages. What about Muslim and Hindu marriages? Following the legalization of polygamous marriages of Africans, procedures were also put in place to legalize Muslim marriages, which are or could be polygamous. In July of 23, the South African Law Reform Commission submitted a report on Islamic marriages and related matters, that was Project 59, for the enactment of a law that would legalize Muslim marriages under the same conditions of, among other things, gender equality, upholding the provisions of the Constitution in such marriages within the Muslim community. This caused havoc within the Muslim community, because there's an influential body within the Islamic community that want Muslim marriages to be recognized as marriages so as to secure gender equality. But there's also, within the Muslim community, it seems to be a predominant influential group that argues we would rather have our marriages not recognized than to deviate from the dictates of the Quran. And this caused great havoc within the Islamic community. The Women's Legal Center Trust brought an application to the Constitutional Court to compel the legislature to enact a law that was drafted by the South African Law Reform Commission to legalize Muslim marriages. Their affidavits were presented to the Constitutional Court, amongst others by Farhan Patel, that complained about the fact that the proposed legislation did not comply with Islamic law. The South African Constitutional Court, quite wisely, I think, decided not to force the legislature to enact this legislation. The reasoning was that this is a very sensitive area and that the South Africa must wait for the Islamic community to sort it out within their own ranks and come to the legislature and say what they really want. Since I'm running out of time, I'm not going to go into details, but let me just say that there are a large number of South African cases that in spite of the fact that Muslim marriages are not recognized as marriages, uphold the consequences of those marriages on the basis of the law of contract. The reasoning of the court being that when you entered into this union, you agreed to do this and not to do that, and you are now contractually bound to do that. And so there are several cases in which consequences of Muslim marriages were upheld in spite of the fact that it's not in the eyes of the law yet a marriage. So, as I say, there are a number of these cases. In question time, you can go into those if you want to do so. Let me just say a final word about Hindu marriages. The South African law has been less accommodating in regard to Hindu marriages. I have noted two cases. The one of Sachitra Singh, who was a lecturer at Natal University and wanted the court to recognize her Hindu marriage so that she can get a divorce from her husband, which she cannot do under Hindu law. The court refused that. They said we cannot legalize a marriage in order to dissolve. And so she was not successful. In a subsequent case of Governor Raghavajan Nomino Fikio, 2009, it was decided that the word spouse in the Intestate Succession Act included a partner to a monogamous Hindu marriage. And I might just say that although Hindu marriages are not recognized because they can in principle be polygamous, my information is that there are not a single polygamous Hindu marriage in South Africa today. They were in the past, but they are no longer Hindu. So we do know that the South African Law Reform Commission is in the moment operating in order to draft legislation to afford legality to Hindu marriages, and it's chaired by Cathy Augustine, whose name I'm sure will be familiar to you all. I'm not going to speak about the legalization of same-sex marriages. We've already talked about that. Let me just in final conclusion say that one of the big problems that confront South Africa in upholding the principles of the Constitution, including gender equality, in these customary traditions is that the South African Bill of Rights was imposed, as we say, from the top down and did not grow from the bottom up. That means that the principles enunciated in the South African Bill of Rights is not part of the mindset of the average South African. And it's not only people of color. Remember that the Afrikaners are also very much opposed to the idea of human rights because that was always the yardstick by which the international community condemned the apartheid regime. So it's very difficult to convince my fellow Afrikaners that the Bill of Rights in the present dispensation is in your interest. So the question that you have, and Judge Yvonne Mokoro in one of the early judgments said, that in applying the principles of the Constitution to African customary communities will take time, need compassion, and lots of understanding, because this is not part of their thinking. And so a big challenge to lawyers in this country and other people is to try to bring the South African community of different factions of the population to accept this wonderful constitutional principles that we have as something that is good and commendable. And let me just conclude by saying, how do you do that? Let me just tell you an anecdote in conclusion. A few years ago, ex-president of the United States, Jimmy Carter, had a project going in Liberia to try to change some of these customary practices that are still being practiced in tribal communities in that country. And just as a point of interest, one of those practices which was on the agenda was the so-called Sassywood method of identifying a witch. The Sassywood is a tree that grows in Liberia with a very poisonous bark. So if they suspect a woman to be a witch, they make a drink of this bark, give it to her to drink. If she dies, it shows she's a witch. If she does not die, she vomits. She can live, it shows she's not a witch. And Jimmy Carter brought together a few of us to say, how can we change this? And I said to him, Mr. President, you cannot change it. As much as I cannot change customs within this country, within tribal communities. If you go to them and say, male circumcision must comply with the following health regulation, they would say, who are you to tell me? So it's something that must grow from within. And at the time I proposed to President Carter to bring members of these tribal communities to the Carter Center, indoctrinate them, and send them back to the communities to bring change from within, because you cannot change from without. And unfortunately, President Carter did not want to do that. He said, if the people of Liberia come to Atlanta and see the good life in America, they don't want to go back. And I did not agree with that because I was part of a program of Columbia University after the demise of communism that brought young scholars from Eastern Europe to New York and indoctrinated them in the paradigm of human rights and then sent them back so that they could change the perceptions in their own communities. And not a single one of those, it was a condition that they had to go back to their country, not a single one of those stayed in the United States. So it is a very challenging task to bring communities in South Africa to live up to the standards of our constitution, as I said, because it was imposed upon them from the top down and did not grow from the bottom up. And change within these communities cannot be imposed upon them. I mean, we can pass, have lovely judgments in our courts, and many of this community says, thank you very much, and then just continue on their own traditional way to almost say, who are you to tell me? And this is something that must grow from within, and we have to cultivate this culture of human rights protection also within the family environment so as to bring about meaningful change in our country. Thank you.
Thank you very much, Professor Mafeyfeld. So time now for some questions. It is a special request that if you do have a question that you please stand so that the cameraman can capture you as well.
I fully understand that you have also in religious traditions certain practices that are unacceptable under contemporary norms of human rights protection. I'm sure that I can quote Bible texts to show that the man is head of the family and the wife must be subservient to him. But there is an ethos in the world today that deviates quite considerably from old practices and institutions, many of which has a cultural or a religious base. But as people are more advanced, they live up to contemporary standards. I was in the United States at the time when gender equality came onto the agenda. And I can tell you long stories of how strongly that was resisted, but has now come to be more or less accepted. The United States is at the moment at the beginning are thinking about equal treatment of gays and lesbians. They still have a long way to go to come to accept it. And I might just mention that when the law that legalized gay marriages in South Africa was adopted, Parliament was instructed by the Constitutional Court to change the Marriage Act in order to legalize same-sex marriages. Parliament couldn't bring itself to do so because a very large percentage of South Africans, including the members of the African National Congress, was dead against it. And so they followed a procedure which is very uncommon in South African law, but I believe it is lawful, of adopting the law without any debate or vote, so that no one is on record as having voted for or against it. And instead of changing the marriage law, they opted for the separate but equal alternative of having a separate law that deals with same-sex marriages. I'm not even sure that this is in conformity with the Constitutional Court instructions, but everybody has come just to accept that. So it is very difficult. That is a good example of how our Constitutional Court compelled the legislature to take action to bring our practice in conformity with the constitutional principles, albeit imposed from the top down, and hopefully to bring about a culture in this country that will in the long run be in conformity with our wonderful constitutional principles.
Of our next speaker.
Over a cup of coffee or a glass of wine?
Well, the choice is yours.